This is News in Notes. I'm Ed Gordon. On today's roundtable, Mrs. King is hospitalized and terror cultivated in a U.S. prison. Joining us from our New York bureau, Michael Myers, executive director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition. Julianne Malveau, economist and author, is joining us from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. And Eric Deggans, columnist for the St. Petersburg Times, is joining us from the Poynter Institute in St. Petersburg, Florida. All right, folks, let us talk briefly, if we can, about the hospitalization of Mrs. King. Certainly prayers are being sent out to her, and it is common knowledge, quite frankly, for those in the know, if you will, that Mrs. King has been ailing for a little while now. One of the things that we wanted to do is use this opportunity with the knowledge that another civil rights stalwart, Fred Shuttlesworth, had surgery this week for a tumor that was removed, a brain tumor. As we look at the aging civil rights icons, if you will, Eric, what does this mean, if anything, to the movement in and of itself?
Well, I think one thing it highlights is the difficulty in finding successors to these people. You talk to folks at the NAACP's and the urban leagues across the country, and you find that they have difficulty finding people to run local organizations and regional organizations. The national NAACP, had its problems in sort of finding a replacement for Kwesi Mfume. Where is the new generation of leaders? That's one reason. Obviously, we value these people's experience and expertise, but we also say, is there anybody to replace them?
Michael Myers?
Well, I think it's premature to write Coretta Scott King's obituary right now. She's 78 years old. When you're in your 70s, it's regarded as the range of mortality. And the body starts to fall apart, you have problems. With respect to the question, I wish her well in terms of the possibility of a speedy recovery. But the question you raise, for me, raises the question of memory, institutional memory in terms of the King Center, in terms of the civil rights movement, in terms of the NAACP and other civil rights groups. People who are aging, who are no longer with us, had memories of segregation and discrimination, and had memories of the tactics and the strategies and the purposes and the mission of their organizations. And it's up to them, it seems to me, before they become frail, to appoint and to designate people who are their protégés. Kenneth Bancroft Clark, the famous social psychologist, and Roy Wilkins, the head of the NAACP for 22 years, designated me as their protege when I was quite young, and then when they were still young and able. So I think civil rights leaders must have proteges and must train people to take over.
You know, Ed, it's interesting. Mrs. King, as Michael says, is 78. We expect to have her around for a long time. Her role has primarily been, though, a symbolic role. She's not been the head of an organization or even actively involved as the head of the King Center for quite some time. She's a phenomenal speaker, as you well know, and a wonderful woman, but she's had a symbolic role. The greater issue, of course, is the status of the civil rights movement. And one might argue that the civil rights movement has been somewhat unsuccessful in making an appropriate transition into the 21st century. The signs don't say white or colored anymore. The issues are not as stark. And many young people, Gen X, Gen Y, are not as interested in the civil rights movement. There's not a Michael Myers to the Wilkins who would pick up the baton. Even when you identify some of these young people, they're more interested in corporate life or in other things than they are in the movement. And yet we have the Voting Rights Act coming up, and yet we have some other issues to deal with. And so I think that, you know, her mortality reminds us of a movement that really needs some new vitality.
Let me ask this then. Does this speak to the success or failure, or both if you can have that, of the civil rights movement in the sense, Julianne, as you suggest, that there are new avenues that are open to this younger generation? Or is it that we did not, in fact, teach the younger generation what they needed to know and understand the importance of going into these fields?
And, you know, I would say that the failure has been in our generation, the baby boom generation, that in some of the economic research I've done, I've called us the golden cohort, the beneficiaries of affirmative action and opening corporate doors and that kind of thing. How many of us, that generation, are really immersed in the civil rights movement as leaders. So it makes sense that those who come behind us look at us and see us in media, in corporate, and other places, and don't necessarily see that. So we have a lot to deal with. The other failure really is that, as Myers mentioned a couple minutes ago, of the civil rights...
You may call me Michael.
I call you whatever I want to, my brother. You know, we go back. And we're not fussing. We go back. But in any case, as Michael said a few minutes ago, the passing of the baton, the formality of that. I moderated a panel on youth leadership about a year ago, and y'all would chuckle to note that our brother Jesse Jackson pulled up the chair to sit at the panel. I'm like, Reverend, you're not youth leadership. Some have been reluctant to move their move off their perch, or to really welcome younger people in.
Well, I agree with Julianne. I think that some of our civil rights leaders have not only been reluctant, I think they've been dinosaurs. They've stayed too long, and they haven't moved on. They should move off the stage. But at the same time, as barriers have been removed and opportunities have been opened up for young minority people in fields that they were previously closed to them, at the same time, there are civil rights groups such as the NAACP that have a large youth contingent. There are 60,000 youth members of the NAACP. They have 7 young members of the National Board of 64. But the point is that they had to, and they have like thousands of chapters and branches throughout the country, but they had to tap an outsider for the next president of the NAACP. And one must wonder, why? Why?
Great point.
Well, I would respectfully note that I think in some ways the struggle has moved to different venues. I'm very involved with the National Association of Black Journalists. I lead the chapter in the Tampa Bay area, and I will tell you that there's no lessening in the thirst amongst the younger people that I see entering the journalism business to cover civil rights issues and to see equality and justice within the media industry. And we have no problem getting these kids involved with all of the different issues that we're doing to try and bring equality to the media industry. And so I think maybe these fights have moved from the more traditional civil rights venues to the boardrooms, to the jobs fairs, to the newspapers, to places where we're not used to maybe seeing the civil rights struggle.
But Eric, you cannot call a jobs fair. This is part of the issue, I think, with the younger people. You cannot call a jobs fair, which is, quite frankly, career development, civil rights. I mean, you have lots of activity in NABJ and National Association of Black Accountants, Black MBA. That's about careerism as much as it is about civil rights. What about the folks who don't have the opportunities, who haven't been to college? Remember that if we look at people over age 25, it's only less than 20% of us have been to college. So what about the rest of the folks?
Well, I would tell you that if you went to the NAACP, to the NABJ convention recently in Atlanta, you would see that a great deal of our panels went far beyond careerism and jobs and talked about the issues of the day and covering the issues of the day and making sure that people are represented at all levels of the media. And one way you affect change is by making sure that people's voices are heard and making sure their issues are covered. So there's a civil rights component to what we do at NABJ that goes beyond just getting people good jobs.
Except a lot of journalists don't know anything about civil rights or the history thereof.
All right, that being said, we'll move our attention to another story in the headlines, and this from ABC News and their fine investigative reporter, Brian Ross, there. It is said that there is a terrorist plot that was uncovered, supposedly in the midst of planning to attack military and Jewish sites in Los Angeles around or on September 11th. This came out of the New Folsom Prison there. It is said that two cellmates, Peter Martinez, a former Oakland Street gang member, and Kevin James, organized this plot and were recruiting as many as 13 inmates to have a jihad against the United States unfold in the streets of Los Angeles. We are also hearing from many officials that Al-Qaeda recruits in prisons fairly regularly. Michael Myers, when you hear this, what's your thought?
Oh, please. You know, there's a danger, really, of equating garden variety criminal conspiracies and garden variety punks who are thugs and inmates and who have fantasies. There's a danger of equating this with quote-unquote terrorism. And we have to, and the stories I read about this have a big question mark after terrorist plot in California prison. So, maybe Al-Qaeda does recruit in prisons. I would not be surprised if it doesn't. A lot of people recruit in prisons, including other thugs. But I think the law enforcement authorities must be careful to make sure that people who are engaged in criminal conspiracies are brought up on charges of criminal conspiracy, not this big thing about terrorism and necessarily tying it and connecting it to Al-Qaeda without any evidence. Where's the evidence?
Julianne Malveaux, what's interesting here to me is the idea of whether or not Al-Qaeda, in the true sense, is recruiting in prison. It has become a catch-all phrase. It casts a wide net now. It's almost given to anyone who talks about some kind of, quote, terror in the United States. But what's most interesting here is that we are seeing people disenfranchised in the United States who are finding a home under that umbrella.
Well, you know, prisons are clearly people who are in prison are socially alienated. I mean, they're gang members. They've broken the law. They're angry. And this is probably, you know, fertile terrain for Al-Qaeda or anybody else to recruit. I agree with Michael Myers. We first of all have to be careful to make sure that everything doesn't fall under the umbrella of terrorism. I mean, people in prison are bad actors by and large. We don't expect them to get up in the morning and pledge a flag and be good citizens. If they were doing that, they wouldn't be in jail. So one of the things that we need to look at here is the underlying roots of some of the social alienation and prison conditions. Do these folks have access to the internet? Because Al-Qaeda is now a very decentralized organization, extremely decentralized. So do these people have access to the internet in prison? Are there some kinds of ways that can be shut off or certain sites restricted? Who are you rooming together? I know in the California prisons there have been a whole bunch of things about who was collected together and what kinds of ways and what that meant. And so I think there's some questions that need to be raised there. But if these are bad actors who are planning, you know, attacks on synagogues or anything else, they ought to be punished as criminal conspirators, not necessarily as terrorists.
I would say that connection between terrorism and crime is nothing new. We know that the IRA was involved with several bank robberies in Britain. We know that the Taliban has regularly been involved with heroin smuggling. So the idea that there may be people in prison who are involved with Al-Qaeda is certainly not surprising. But one note of caution is that we know that the investigative tools available to law enforcement when they're pursuing terrorism allegations are much more, they have much more leeway, they have much more powers of investigation. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see law enforcement try to brand more crimes as terrorism related because they know they have more investigative latitude. So while we want to be careful about making sure that we know the nature of these threats in the prison, we also want to be careful to make sure we're not handing too much authority over to law enforcement because they have a tendency to brand, cast a wide net, as you said yourself, Ed.
All right, let's turn our attention now to the borders here in the United States, out west in particular. And this is something that obviously we've been following for some time. Most recently, the governors of Arizona and New Mexico have declared a state of emergency, citing a surge in smuggling and violence along the borders. They're also faulting American and Mexican authorities and are suggesting that monies be freed up, federal and state monies, to strengthen local law enforcement efforts to keep these borders secure. Michael Myers, we've been hearing about this for some time, but now we're seeing individual governors jumping to action and try to jumpstart a movement from the federal government.
Yeah, but the declarations of emergency aren't what they used to be. I remember when governors never declared a state of emergency unless there was real insurrection in the streets and real riots going on, and then you needed support. You needed to suspend the Constitution or the state Constitution and the usual laws in order to deal with an emergency. This is not a declaration of emergency. This is a fundraising gimmick. It's a publicity stunt, in my judgment. And you know, both governors are up for re-election, as governors will be in the United States of America. So I don't buy it. I'm sure there is a surge in smuggling, and there is, quote-unquote, violence around the border, along the border, and some people have been shot at and there is a crime situation. But it's not what one we regard as a state of emergency worthy of a declaration of emergency. This is
Michael Myers, you're absolutely wrong here. You are absolutely wrong. These governors, basically all these Homeland Security things have become an unfunded mandate for states. What we have begun to do at the federal level is starve states. And so you have, first of all, you cannot secure borders. The notion of securing borders is one that we really need to revisit. You cannot have an impermeable border. Mexico has been at fault because it does not have a stable economy with good jobs. The United States has been at fault because we have not resolved our issues of immigration policy after Mr. Bush promised to do it in 2000. We still haven't gone there. But these governors are faced with hundreds of millions of dollars of costs that they cannot pay. They have a choice of taking money out of seniors' mouths, charging people for school buses, or dealing with these borders. It is an emergency, a fiscal emergency, but it's also a criminal emergency.
So they should declare a state of emergency when schools can't be financed and when every
they should
state
declare
activity
a state of
cannot
American,
be financed?
They should declare a state of emergency when a situation has gotten out of control and they believe they cannot handle it without federal support, when an issue has gone under the table and they believe that it needs national attention. I commend these governors in raising these issues because these issues will not go away. In addition, we have seen people coming across borders in ways that have been not only illegal but dangerous, people dying in trucks
all
right, and
all
Eric,
of this. I got to give you the last 40 seconds. Your
I was going to play peacemaker here. I suggested both of you guys are right.
That's impossible.
No, it's not. Well, I'm right.
All right, last 30 seconds,
well,
Eric.
I want to say you're both right because I believe what we have here is we have not resolved our ambivalence about illegal immigration. Just before this story came out, we were seeing stories from California and from other states saying that farmers were having trouble gathering their crops because the crackdown on illegal immigration was cutting down on their workforce. We have economies, whole economies, our farming economy especially, that is dependent on illegal immigration, even though we have laws against these people in, you know, entering the country. So we have to sort of resolve how we feel about this as a nation. So it's good that these governors are bringing this to the table, but they're up for re-election, and they're trying to explain the rise in violent crime in their area connected to illegal immigration, and this is also a handy way to do it.
All right. Michael Myers, Julianne Malvo, Eric Deggans, we thank you very much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Ed.
Unfortunately, we won't get to the baby threats to aviation, eh?
Oh,
next
well.
Time.